Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for, well, an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. Few people are making a more outsized contribution to our understanding of that war, and I think to its conduct, than our first guest. He is Andrew McCarthy. He formerly served as a federal prosecutor, responsible, among other things, for putting away the perpetrators of the first attack on the World Trade Center. And he has, since leaving government, made an incredible contribution to all of us in terms of his writings daily, it seems, at National Review Online and PJ Media, and of course his best-selling books, including most recently Faithless Execution, making the political case for Obama's impeachment. Andy, welcome back. Always good to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Frank.
Well, Ferguson is much on all of our minds at the moment in the aftermath of the decision handed down by a grand jury there in Missouri last night. Talk a little bit about the grand jury process, first of all, what this particular finding by this particular grand jury portends, and whether justice is in fact being served.
Well, Frank, I think the first thing to recognize about our criminal process is that a lot of tragic things happen that are not criminal offenses. And I think this, unfortunately, falls into the category of that, and always has for those of us who, you know, have had to apply the criminal law over the years.
The rule of law that the president speaks about and sometimes observes.
Well, yeah, and the rule of law applied here does not always satisfy everyone, especially people who want poetic justice, in, at least in their own minds, rather than real down-on-the-ground justice. I mean, what happened here is that a police officer encountered an 18-year-old who was unarmed but acting in evidently a menacing fashion, and there was an altercation, and the man died.
Menacing fashion, as I understand it, he actually whacked the police officer a couple of times while he was sitting in his squad car. That's pretty damn menacing.
The best spin for the for the people who want to make a big to-do out of this, and obviously Ferguson is being burnt to the ground, so there's obviously people who are agitating. Unfortunately, by the way, the arrest records seem to indicate that a lot of them come from out of state, so I suspect that these are, you know, more in lines of professional agitators than they are residents of Ferguson, who you wouldn't think have an interest in building their, burning their town to the ground.
People like Al Sharpton, who I understand the president of the United States actually encouraged to stay on course with respect to Ferguson, whatever that means.
Yeah, it really is amazing. President Obama gave a speech last night after the announcement was made, which, if that had been all he said, I think for him would have probably been, by his standards, a pretty good speech. But I think it comes against the context and the full background of the administration having done an awful lot to incite what is happening in Ferguson.
Notably, your friend, the Attorney General, Eric Holder.
Yes, who seems to have a growing, evolving friendship and partnership with Reverend Al Sharpton. So, which is something I think could probably do nobody any good, particularly when you have a Justice Department whose legacy under Holder will be the racially discriminatory enforcement of the federal law in, I think, blatant violation of the Constitution and of all the awful things Holder's done, and they are legion. To my mind, that stands out as the worst one.
Yeah, it's really reprehensible in the extreme. And to the extent that this thing does, in fact, metastasize further and result in violence at the hands of people who seem to be prepositioned for perpetrating it elsewhere around the country, that misconduct is well, criminal.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate that the police, on the one hand, are being asked to keep order, and on the other hand, you know, the president seems to be waving, you know, the bloody shirt at a lot of the protesters and telling the police that, you know, they need to show restraint. So I, you know, if you're a police officer, you have to wonder what, you know, what do I do here, and do I want to end up being the next Officer Wilson, which, you know, I would imagine most of them don't want that.
After seeing what's happened to this fellow, I can't imagine anybody would want it. But Andy, you've written a very important piece, and I just want to call attention to it at the corner, the sort of blog of National Review Online today, about the importance of this Fifth Amendment piece and the jury.
Yeah, the importance of the Fifth Amendment right, which I think has really been lost in the commentary, Frank. You have a lot of people who say, you know, what would have been the problem of just having the grand jury return an indictment so then we could have an open trial and everybody would see that there was no case, and if he got acquitted at the trial, that would be more satisfying to the community, because at least we would have had the trial out in the open. And my response to that is, the Constitution protects the right to be indicted, and it's often one that's overlooked, it's one that's never spoken about, but the grand jury's function, and the reason it's in the Constitution, is to be the buffer between the potential of prosecutorial overreach and the community. The reason that you have a right to be indicted is the government is supposed to be able to show that there's a basis, a probable cause, to bring you to trial before putting you through the expense, the anxiety of facing a criminal trial. And you not only have that legal protection, but let's think of the logic of this idea that, you know, let's have the trial anyway and ignore the grand jury. If the grand jurors are being pressured to indict in the absence of probable cause, what's to say then that the trial jurors won't face the same pressure to convict in the even more stark absence of evidence beyond a reasonable doubt?
No, it's a critical point, Andy. And I think, you know, this is really one of the things that stands between us and the lynch mob, which is what it really seems most of these demonstrators are after. Irony of ironies, having, you know, ostensibly found their footing in the origins of a civil rights movement, it was based in part on trying to prevent lynch mobs from doing this kind of violence to blacks and other minorities. Andy, let me turn quickly, and we don't have time to do nearly justice to this, but let's begin the conversation with you at least about another issue that the president has also engaged in, I believe, very, very reprehensibly, and that is this executive amnesty. What do you make of what he's done and its implications?
Well, I think basically he's torn the Constitution asunder yet again. He's essentially usurped the power of the legislature, the Congress, to control the rules that govern the conditions that non-Americans have to satisfy in order to be present in the United States legally. And aside from what it's done in terms of encouraging a raft of more illegal immigration, and I suspect it'll be a lot more than 5 million by the time it's all said and done, what he has also done is made it toxic and therefore impossible to arrive at a political solution to the problem of immigration, illegal immigration that plagues the United States. So he's, in the end, I think he's really undermined what he says is his goal, which is, you know, to settle this issue.
Yeah. Andy, did you have a chance to look at the Office of Legal Counsel memo? And very quickly, what did you make of the legal justification it served up?
Well, I thought it was interesting that that President Obama, that the Office of Legal Counsel seems to be trying to, you know, throw some restraints on what a president can do in the way of not enforcing the law without violating his oath to execute the laws faithfully. And the interesting thing to me is that, you know, President Obama is simply beelining right past his own OLC.
Well, among other things, as you say, the Constitution, the OLC, the Congress of the United States, and I think the will of the American people are all now very much in peril at the hands of this president. Andy, we appreciate enormously what you're doing to help not only chronicle these things, but make sense of them and offer very constructive suggestions as to how to contend with them. Thank you for doing it here and at National Review Online, PJ Media, Fox News, and elsewhere. Keep it up. Come back to us again next week. We'll talk next with Fred Flights about Iran and what the president and company are doing on that front right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts. Now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Fred Flights, a career intelligence professional, now a senior fellow, I'm pleased to say, at the Center for Security Policy. You see his writings and him in the flesh, in fact, in myriad outlets, including prominently in Fox News these days. Fred has been a career Central Intelligence Agency analyst, chief of staff to Ambassador John Bolton at the State Department, and a professional staff member of the House Intelligence Committee. All important credentials for talking about the subject du jour, Freddy, which is, of course, Iran. Welcome back. It's good to have you with us, my friend.
Good to be here, Frank.
You've been tracking this very closely for a long time, going back to your days at the agency, Fred. What do you make of where we find ourselves at the moment with respect to the effort to negotiate a deal to put an end to Iran's nuclear weapons ambitions?
There's two sides here, essentially, Frank. I know there's a multilateral talks, but it's really between the United States and Iran. There's a state desperately wants talks, and there's a state that's trying to take advantage of that. The United States desperately wants the talks, desperately wants an agreement. The Iranians are trying to take advantage of that to get the best deal possible. What was agreed to yesterday was an extension of the negotiations. So there's supposed to be a political framework by the 1st of March, and then a final agreement by the 1st of July. But the reason that it's being blamed for the delay is because the Iranians want immediate and full relief of sanctions. But that's really not the reason. The reason there's been a problem is over in Richmond. Enormous concessions made by the United States to allow Iran to enrich uranium that I've concluded and other experts concluded will give Iran we're not just conceding to Iran the bomb, we will be conceding to Iran the capability to make multiple nuclear bombs.
We're visiting with Fred Flights, a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy and expert on matters involving Iran's nuclear weapons ambitions and programs. And Fred, we were talking about the fact that the Iranians are being allowed under the deal such as it has been established so far, and it's not quite done. There are a few more months that will be spent in developing a political framework and then finalizing the rest of the deal by July. But as a practical matter, much of the basic framework of it is in place, as I understand it now. To the extent that it is, how verifiable do you think it is? And if we're being told that this will be the thing that keeps Iran from breaking out, can we have confidence that we will know that they're in the process of doing that?
Well, verification is the key, and it rests on a conclusion, which I think is an erroneous conclusion, that an Iranian weapon can't be stopped, so we have to live with it. But to live with it, we have to have intrusive verification to make sure that an agreement with the Iranians is going to be complied with. The Obama administration claims they're going to have this verification using the IAEA to keep Iran a year away from making a nuclear weapon.
That's the International Atomic Energy Agency, of course.
Yeah, that's right. And there's two problems with that. First of all, Iran has not cooperated with the IAEA during the talks. There's various facilities it was supposed to give the IAEA access to. It refused to do that. It was supposed to answer outstanding questions about weapons-related work. It refused to do that. But there's a bigger question, and I know former CIA Director Hayden has mentioned that, and that's the possibility of covert nuclear facilities. There are many Enigma facilities in Iran. We don't know what they are. We know that uranium enrichment facilities can be hidden. The North Koreans successfully did that for a number of years. We didn't even know they had one until they showed it to a group of academics in 2011. If Iran has covert enrichment facilities, they could be very, very close to making nuclear fuel right now, and we would know nothing about it.
And Fred, it's been pointed out to me that hiding a large industrial facility used for enriching uranium is one thing. Hiding a relatively small facility, perhaps the size, as one intelligence professional put it, of a school classroom, to actually facilitate and engage in the assembling of a nuclear weapon is a totally different verification targeting problem. And my guess is that we have some of both taking place covertly in Iran today. And as a result, Fred, as again, a career intelligence professional, are we really being sold a bill of goods by John Kerry and Wendy Sherman and Barack Obama when they talk about this being a deal that we'll be able to have confidence in is being abided by the Iranians.
There are so many statements here that I just think are false. I don't see how they can possibly claim the IAEA or the West has any capability to verify an agreement like this. But on top of that, they're lying about how close Iran is to a weapon right now. Just using the reactor-grade uranium, Iran could make enough fuel for one weapon in 2.2 to 3.5 months. There are experts on the air claiming that the program is capped, that they rolled it back, that Iran has been substantially set back in its effort to make nuclear weapons because of the interim deal signed last November. That isn't true. So to build a final agreement on all these untruths about the interim agreement, I just think is has become a debacle.
A debacle indeed. And Fred, you know, there is this other problem, as you know so well. As a young man, I had the privilege of working in the Reagan Pentagon under an Undersecretary of Defense by the name of Fred Eclay. And Fred had previously been the director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and had written a very thoughtful and influential piece entitled After Detection, What? Which is to say that you not only have the problem of verification, and you're right that this is going to be very, very difficult with respect to this deal, with respect to the infrastructure the Iranians are allowed to retain and trying to make sure that we understand exactly what they're doing with it, especially when you add on top of it the covert facilities. But even if we do detect, even if we do see that they're now breaking out and moving very quickly towards having full up nuclear capabilities, do you have any confidence, Fred, that this administration is going to do anything about that?
No, and I'll give you a good example. There's a facility in Iran called the Parchin Military Facility. There's strong evidence that Iran has conducted research there on how to make a nuclear warhead explosive testing. We had this evidence for a long time. We've confronted the Iranians. They denied it. They won't let the IAEA into check. And there's been no consequences. We're on the verge of striking an agreement with Iran, despite the fact that it refuses to come clean on Parchin. This is just one of many examples of facilities across the across Iran with a strong evidence of weapons-related work. We've confronted the Iranians with it, and they've just ignored us.
Fred, I just want to get one thing down beyond all of this. You've very helpfully laid out the case against what they're doing. But what, in your estimation, should Congress do now in light of what the administration has just agreed upon?
It's very important that Congress not fall for the argument, let's give the talks more time. They were on the verge of passing tough sanctions last December. The administration talked Democrats out of it. Congress has to say right now, stop. The interim agreement was not in U.S. interest because we conceded uranium enrichment to the Iranians, which is giving them an increasing capability to make nuclear weapons. All the Republicans in the Senate are solidly for this. Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, a Democrat, came out last week to say he wants a total dismantlement of the Iranian nuclear program, not simply a freeze, not conceding in enrichment centrifuges. I think this is really big. Congress has to repudiate the talks and any deal they result in, say no sanctions relief until Iran comes clean on its nuclear activities, and impose new sanctions until it answers questions about its nuclear program.
Seems eminently sensible to me. I hope very much with your good work, Fred Flights, and the clarity of the message that you're providing, among others, that the Congress will see its way clear to doing exactly that. We'll be following it closely, as will you. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we will be speaking with Yoram Edinger. We'll get an Israeli perspective on why this problem with Iran is not just Israel's to take account of, but also ours as well. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has evidently been forced to resign. Notwithstanding President Obama's public expression of appreciation at the White House yesterday, we're entitled to know why Hagel was fired. Some say it was over policy disputes concerning how best to combat Ebola or the Islamic State. Perhaps the president no longer needs a token Republican in the cabinet or simply wants to appoint the nation's first female Secretary of Defense. A clue as to the real reason for Hagel's sudden departure, however, may lie in his recent announcement that urgent action and over $1 billion was needed to prop up our obsolescing nuclear deterrent. But Team Obama favors a policy of atrophy and attrition that would, quote, rid the world of nuclear weapons, unquote, starting with ours. So, goodbye, Chuck Hagel. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, I'm thrilled to say, joined by a man I've come to admire greatly over the years as an authority not only on what are the security interests and concerns of his native land, Israel, but also those that should be of concern to us in the United States, the importance of the U.S.-Israeli relationship, and so much more. He is Ambassador Yoram Edinger. He served in the highest ranks of the Israeli diplomatic corps, including as the Minister for Congressional Affairs at the Israeli Embassy in Washington. Today he is with the Second Thoughts Initiative and is widely regarded, I think, on both sides of the Atlantic as one of the go-to guys on matters of security and the threats there, too. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back. It's always a pleasure to have you with us, sir.
Thank you very much.
We're taking stock with a number of our guests of the deal that is still apparently being cooked with Iran. A lot of misgivings have been expressed about it already, but I'm very interested in getting an Israeli perspective on what has been not quite completed, but I think we know enough about the broad outlines of it to give us a sense of where this thing is headed over the next couple of months. What are your thoughts, Mr. Ambassador?
Well, what we have right now is a scenario which plays into Iran's hands. Every day which goes by is a net gain for Iran, getting them closer to nuclear capabilities. The mere idea that one can conclude an agreement with a regime which has demonstrated itself as a serial violator of all previous agreements is a grotesque process. We are talking about a regime which is ruled by the Ayatollahs and the Mullahs who have not made secret of their anti-American, anti-Western world intentions. This is a regime which is a close strategic ally with North Korea, with which they develop further ballistic and nuclear capabilities. This is a regime with very close ties with the unpredictable anti-American regime in Venezuela. This is a chief sponsor of Islamic terrorism, responsible for the murder of hundreds of people in the Western world, and we are supposed to assume that this is a regime which is expected to abide by an agreement, and I think it's time to stop subordinating realism to the whims of wishful thinking.
Very well said, of course, and all right on, it seems to me, Ambassador Yoram Ettinger. Your Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, said on American television over the weekend, as you may know, that a no-deal situation is better than a bad-deal situation. I'm wondering whether, based on your long experience with the diplomatic dance, you would say we are in a no-deal mode at the moment, or whether what we really have is kind of a stay of execution, perhaps, but that either of two things is happening. One, as you say, the Iranians are simply running out the clock, building feverishly their nuclear weapons capabilities. Or two, they are basically going to get this bad deal maybe a couple of months from now. Its basic outlines having been defined.
Well, it seems to me that there is a very strange and self-defeating process here as far as the Western world is concerned. On one hand, we have Iran, which is driven by a strategic goal, namely to achieve the mega capability, nuclear capability. And on the other hand, we have the U.S. administration, which is driven by tactic, not by strategic goal, namely tactic to achieve an agreement. That provides, again, the Iranians with a significant edge. My own observation has been that the U.S. administration is determined to achieve an agreement, irrespective of the nature of the agreement. They try to get, according to their perception, as better an agreement as possible. But once again, we are talking not only about the Iranian regime, we're talking about the Middle East, where most agreements historically have been signed on ice rather than carved in stone. The tragedy is that this administration in Washington is determined to engage Iran in a dialogue, in a diplomatic dialogue, rather than preempt. The only way to prevent the nuclearization of Iran, in my mind, is a military preemption. By the way, military preemption with absolutely no boots on the ground. Anybody who claims that a military preemption could involve the U.S. in another ground warfare is either dramatically mistaken or outrageously misleading, because with the U.S. military presence in Qatar, in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia, in Oman, the one or two aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf, the Indian Ocean bases, to preempt militarily and destroy 20-30% of the vital nuclear infrastructure in Iran would amount to relatively simple military exercise. And if it doesn't work after the first or second sorties, you carry out the third sortie. And you can carry it out through the Air Force, you can carry it out through naval operations. There is no need for boots on the ground. And U.S. refusal, U.S. refraining from a military preemption, once again plays into the hands of Iran, because they know that there is no intention to comply, and at the same time, U.S. refraining only further emboldens the regime, because it subdues the opposition in Iran, which views the U.S. being supposedly deterred by the regime. And therefore, the chance of regime change is getting farther and farther the more reluctant is the U.S. to preempt Iran.
And the more we release or relieve them of the burden of sanctions and all the rest of it. Mr. Ambassador, you've made a powerful case for preemptive action. And again, we're speaking with Ambassador Yoram Edinger, currently with the Second Thoughts Initiative in Israel, a former minister for congressional affairs at the Israeli embassy in Washington. Is this not likely to be as important and necessary a step for Israel as it should be for the United States, both countries having been put on notice by Ayatollah Khamenei that they're in his crosshairs, Israel being wiped off the map being an obvious and oft-stated goal, and a world without America being something that the regime has talked about for many years as well. But what about Israel and its requirement to act in the manner that you've just talked about, even if the United States chooses not to?
First of all, the military preemption is considered by Iran to be the most panicky option, and we saw it back in 2003 when Iran stopped the development of nuclear capabilities because they assumed that the 2003 war in Iraq was a prelude to a U.S. offensive against Iran. By the way, just like Hafez Assad of Syria, who suddenly became very, very frail in Syria in 2003. But both Iran and Syria realized very soon that the U.S. had no intention to proceed, and therefore Hafez Assad persisted with the oppression of his people and the development of chemical capabilities, and Iran proceeded with the nuclear capabilities. As far as the Israeli angle, in my mind, it's a secondary or tertiary issue here. Israel has no relevance to the prime objective of Iran, which is domination of the Persian Gulf. The mega historical goal of Iran has always been the domination of the Persian Gulf. It goes back to the 7th century and maybe beyond that. On the way of attaining their mega goal, they have a mega obstacle. That mega obstacle has nothing to do with Israel. It's the moral and military power projection of the U.S. in the Gulf, in the Middle East, in the Indian Ocean, etc.
Assuming we're going to bring it to bear, Mr. Ambassador, and with that, I'm afraid we have to leave it. Thank you very much for joining us, Ambassador Yoram Edinger. Your insights are always appreciated. We'll both be following this story closely, and we hope to talk with you again about it very soon. We're going to talk next with Bill Roggio of the Long War Journal. We'll get his take on the Chuck Hagel resignation and more after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hello, I'm Jim Hansen, and welcome to the Free Fire Zone. President Obama has demanded that Congress act on amnesty for undocumented migrants, or he will. Where is that in the Constitution? It's certainly not in my copy. Mine says that Congress makes laws and the executive just enforces them. The president has the support of a mere 26% of the country for his amnesty plan. But he seems to think he can ignore the rest of us and our elected representatives to do what he thinks is best. The American voters have spoken. Obama just doesn't seem to care. So Congress either bows to the demands of the imperial executive and passes amnesty and open borders immigration, or the Obama will do so by decree.
So let it be written. So let it be done.
Now, this matters a lot for several reasons. One is his disgraceful disdain for the will of the American people. We expect our elected leaders to heed our opinions as expressed at the ballot box. We don't expect to be treated as too stupid to know what we need and have the self-anointed elites lie to us for our own good. It also matters because it is stunningly bad policy. A lot of liberals are squalling right now that Presidents George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan used the same kind of executive power to stop deportations of illegal aliens when we granted amnesty back in 1986. And they did. But at the time, Congress had just passed an amnesty bill. Bush and Reagan were only making sure that the families were not split up while Congress sorted out the details and amended it. They didn't ignore the clear voice of the American people and do the exact opposite. Big difference. How well did that amnesty work? Totally solved the problem, right? Well, some of us, actually most of us, learned our lesson. Obama and his 26% obviously didn't. So we need to stop them. That's one big reason we voted for Republican majorities in the House and Senate. It certainly wasn't for them to allow a reckless executive to run roughshod over the Constitution, endanger our national security, and damage our economy. So listen up, Speaker Boehner and Majority Leader McConnell. Not one dime for amnesty, or for climate mumbo-jumbo, or nuclear disarmament, or deals with Iran. If that takes a government shutdown, then shut it down. That's what we, the people, want. And you still work for us, even if the Pharaoh, I mean president, thinks he doesn't. I'm Jim Hansen, and you've been in the Free Fire Zone.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for a weekly visit, I'm very happy to say, with a man I admire greatly. He is Bill Roggio. He is the managing editor of a terrific online resource called The Long War Journal. It is a product of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And he serves there as a senior fellow. He is also a man who has both personal combat experience as well as time as an embed. So he's got a real insight into how this long war is being fought and what are the consequences of losing it. Bill Roggio, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. It's always a pleasure to join you.
Well, I guess we've got to start with the change of the guard at the Pentagon. President Obama evidently has forced out, though they're dissembling a little bit on this, but it certainly seems as though Chuck Hagel wasn't planning on leaving just now. and yet he is going to be gone shortly. Based on your sources and insights, Bill Roggio, what do you think prompted that changing?
Yeah, I think Hagel was unable to do what Obama wanted him to do as Secretary of Defense, and that was two things, to reduce the size of the military and to manage the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And given the what has happened in the world with Russia, with the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, and a host of other problems, he hasn't been able to do that. So given that Hagel is basically... what Hagel was brought in for political cover for the withdrawal from Afghanistan, as well as to downsize the military. And he's not been able to do either, given the problems with the Islamic State, problems with Russia and the Ukraine, the rise of China's military power, and other global threats. You know, all of these various problems, the Al-Qaeda in Yemen, the problems in North Africa, I mean, we could go on and on. If Hagel, if he can't do what Obama needed, why does he need a guy who isn't really going to bat for the administration? Why does he need him there? I mean, Hagel has said some contradictory things that the administration doesn't want to hear about the Islamic State, for instance. He described them as the greatest threat that we face, as an effective terrorist group. And he did this months after President Obama called them the JV team. So he's not exactly, I'm not saying he was, opposed to Obama's policies, but he wasn't playing ball like Obama wanted him to play, and therefore he's just not needed.
There are a couple of other considerations that seem to be at work here, Bill Roggio, and I think you would agree that the administration has gone to extraordinary lengths to put women into senior leadership positions. And my guess is that Michelle Flournoy is on deck to go in as the next Secretary of Defense, having served as an undersecretary previously in this administration. What do you make of that possibility?
Yeah, she's been passed over twice, and there's been a lot of pressure from, think tanks and various, pressure groups in D.C. And, she may be a qualified as Secretary of Defense. I guess we'll find out if she is appointed, but she'll certainly be more of an Obama team player than I suspect Hagel was. And I'm not really, again, I want to be clear, Hagel wasn't, he was an outsider. I mean, if you read all the reports, basically he may as well have been undersecretary for defense while all the defense policy was made by Obama and his staff.
Bill, one other theory that I've had, and it may be mine alone, but I nonetheless believe that it's not entirely coincidental that this came about shortly after the Secretary of Defense kind of made a major departure from both his own past record and that of the Obama administration on nuclear forces. It turns out that they're going to hell in a handbasket, and he decided he better do something to try to prevent this thing from unraveling completely on his watch, something that I have to tell you, I just get the feeling the president would be delighted to see happen. He's interested in getting rid of nuclear weapons all over the world, it seems, starting with ours. Any thought on that?
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I mean, I don't think the president has had any effective policy on the aging of our nuclear forces.
Other than compounding it.
Yeah, exactly. And he's more than happy to allow our weapons to deteriorate or get rid of ours and without any... look, we'd all love to have a nuclear-free world, but the reality is that we deal with enemies. We have enemies and rivals who don't operate on the same principles as we do.
I'm not sure it would actually be such a good thing, frankly, because we fought a couple of horrific world wars when we had a nuclear-free environment. But I do think that it's absolute insanity. It's malfeasance in a circumstance like we're in today, where you have everybody else on the planet, at least certainly all of the threatening nations on the planet, massively building up their ability to attack us and saying they're willing to do so. Bill, let me turn quickly to another topic that you, of course, been following very closely at the Long War Journal for many, many years. Afghanistan. We mentioned earlier that the Taliban is resurgent there. What is the administration obliged to do now, it appears, to if not depart from its plan for withdrawing altogether, certainly changing the ground rules under which we're going to be operating.
The New York Times reported earlier this week that the administration was going to change the rules of engagement for next year. After the end of this year, the U.S. is going to reduce to 9,800 troops, and they were to be strictly in an advisory role with limited operations to target al-Qaeda and its network only in Afghanistan. Now that's changed, and those forces can be combat forces. They could accompany Afghan troops on the ground, launch airstrikes against the Taliban and other allied groups. But the force structure itself really hasn't changed. So what the administration is doing is allowing them to be in Afghanistan in a combat role. Keep in mind, though, right now, that's better to a degree, but we have about 25,000-30,000 troops on the ground now. And the Taliban has taken territory, and they're going up against Afghan forces. And we have combat rules of engagement now, and the Taliban is resurgent. So I really don't think this is going to change things all that much. It can harm the Taliban. It makes things more difficult for them. Of course, they don't want to be targeted. However, it's going to only change things on the margins. A country the size of Afghanistan, with that number of troops, with limited air forces, limited number of special operations teams, there's only so much they can do. Keep in mind, an administration and a party that railed, and rightfully so, railed against the Bush administration for going small on Afghanistan has completely reverted back to where we were in Afghanistan, say, in 2004, 2005, when things started to go real bad.
And we will see, as we've talked about from time to time, Bill Roggio, things going bad in Afghanistan. I'm puzzled about what that small a number of folks, even if they've got the best rules of engagement and latitude in terms of their operations, will be able to do to effectively engage in combat against insurgents like the Taliban. This will be, of course, perhaps made a bit better if we are now, as I understand from your reporting, able once again to engage in night operations, which for a time under Hamid Karzai we were enjoined from doing. But even so, this is going to get dodgier and dodgier, I'm afraid, as this mission winds down and the Taliban is unquestionably emboldened by our departure. Bill, you'll be following that closely, as will we, with your very considerable help. We appreciate all that you do at the Long War Journal and elsewhere in connection with your responsibilities at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Thanks for joining us each week, and come back to us again in the next one. We hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.